You're tuned to Perspectives, the weekly public affairs show, which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon. I'm Louis Hines, your host for Perspectives. We are talking with John Stewart. He and his daughter, Caitlin, are authors of Hiding in Sunshine. And this is a book that just came out, and it's an interesting book because it's actually about cyberspace. It has to do with a lot of other things that people are very aware of, but sometimes are wondering about how far can they go, how real is this, etc. And so, first of all, let me ask you, John, how did you and your daughter decide to come about writing this book? What made you all decide to come up with writing Hiding in Sunshine?
My older daughter goes to college, and when she got her credit card about 3 years ago, we were giving her lectures like typical parents do. Be careful with the credit card. Don't lose it. Your identity could be compromised. And as we were having that discussion, my younger daughter was listening it carefully and started asking more and more questions. And one of the questions she asked, wait, if parents lose identity, what happens to their children? Whose children are they? And we were dumbfounded, had no idea how to answer that question. So that's where it really started, and she decided to write a story about it. The story got a little bigger, and the story was about the journey of a family as they lose their identity, and they are, and somebody else is stolen, criminals are after them, and they are on the run through different parts of the country. And how do they survive? And then as she was working on it, I had a suggestion for her that while identity theft is a great, relevant idea, cyber war is another one. So there are two parallel tracks, actually, which work into the plot.
You know, it's interesting, John, what you mentioned that while you and your daughter were talking, that your other daughter inquired about if someone steals your identity, whose daughter am I? And that's a very legitimate question because people don't think about that. People think immediately about my bank account, anything else, my credit card, etc. But they don't think about what else goes with your identity.
That's right. That's so true. And I know of people who lost their identity, lost their bank account was frozen, credit cards were frozen. They were not who they were. In fact, I know of case where the person who lost the identity had less proof of her being who she was than the one who had stolen the identity.
So would you say that this story that you and your daughter have written, even though it's considered a novel, fiction, it's partially autobiographical?
It certainly has a lot of elements of reality, and I'll give you an interesting data point on it. I think it was about 2 months ago, Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta gave a speech where he talked about cyber warfare and potentially cyber Pearl Harbor, which could be at any time. And he talked about the risk of financial institutions getting really hacked. He talked about electrical grids getting compromised. He talked about chemical plants, train system. And it was like unbelievable. We had already published the book by then. And we were just looking at it and saying, you know, we were not just imagining this thing. This thing is real. And he was warning us, giving it a huge warning that these things have to be dealt with.
Now, have you dealt with any government officials at all? Have you told them about this book? Are they aware of it?
I have no idea.
And what about any of the other authorities in your hometown, perhaps the police, your pastor, your rabbi, anybody like that?
Not really. I mean, we are not marketeers. We have distributed some of the books to our friends and family. And that's pretty much the extent of it.
Now, how did your background as a high-tech entrepreneur help you in writing this book?
So I have a background in telecom and internet. So I have a fairly good feel for what are the ways things could go wrong in terms of cyber war, for example. I'm not an expert on how to solve the problem, but I certainly know where the skeletons are. And that helped the cause quite a bit.
You know, a lot of people are afraid, and yet a lot of people also took that aside and ordered holiday gifts via the internet. They ordered them without blinking an eye. And yet there are some people who are very afraid of using that sort of marketing because they're afraid of giving away their identity.
It is so true. I mean, it's hard to imagine life without internet now. I mean, I cannot even imagine how did I live 25 years ago without wireless devices and without internet. I think the key is to be aware that what we are doing, it comes with a risk. It's not risk-free. And be cognizant of it, that there are certain precautions one can take, at least to minimize it to the extent one can. I mean, there are simple precautions. For example, some people very easily provide their social security number online. And I'll be very leery of providing my date of birth or social security number online. A lot has to happen before somebody will provide it, before somebody should provide it. People should be careful, for example, in terms of when they go to medical offices or businesses sometimes and they ask for social security number, if you can provide licenses as opposed to social, that will be easier and safer. I mean, there are criminals out there who are filing early tax returns to get the refund check before the person whose identity has been stolen, in this case, let's say, had a chance to file their own tax returns. And that's possible because somebody has stolen the social and date of birth. Another example is that somebody who does not do online banking and they think they are safe, but if somebody has stolen their social and date of birth, they can go and open a bank account on the name of the individual who doesn't have it. So in some sense, you're caught between rock and a hard place. On one side, if you have online, you have the exposure. If you don't do online, you still have the exposure. So the key is to protect social and date of birth to the extent one can.
Let's talk a little bit about something that's kind of hit the world by a wildfire, and that's social media, Facebook. Everybody you know just about has a Facebook account, and that's fine, because I teach a Facebook social media class myself here at the university. However, there are some people who post everything and anything about themselves on Facebook.
That's the dilemma, which is hard to understand. The privacy is getting compromised, and while everybody talks about privacy and so forth, but in practice, very few people actually do anything to protect their privacy. And this could potentially come to haunt them as years go by. It's very easy to put date of birth and even other details on the online. But if somebody then get hold of them as technology gets more and more sophisticated and uses that data to do some things which are criminal things, then I think people will realize it. But and it's already happening. There's no question about that. But I don't know how to increase the awareness. I really hope that, and you're doing that actually by having this radio conversation, to increase the awareness that it comes at a cost. It's a great thing. Facebook is wonderful, actually. It's just that be careful what you put out there.
Why don't you set this up for us? Because here we are talking about cyberspace. We're talking about identity theft. And people may think that the book that we're talking about is basically what to do, what not to do, tips and not to do tips, etc. But it's basically a novel. It's a story. Why don't you take us through the story, John?
Sure. Right. So the book, it's actually a story is more about a family and the two daughters, father, mother, and two daughters, and how when they get into, there's a kidnapping attempt made on the family, and their identities get stolen. And they're put, but at the same time, the protagonist in the story is a net cybersecurity expert, and FBI puts them into a witness protection program. And then a number of events occur where they get abandoned by the government too, and the family is on their own. And how do they interact with each other? And there are constant threats surrounding them, and what do they do in those circumstances? And how do they come together trying to get their life back? So the story is really about an odyssey of family as opposed to all of the details. I mean, the rest is just self-evident as people read the novel. What could they do or what they couldn't have done or shouldn't have done?
As far as what could have been done or what can be done, are we in danger of a cyber attack?
I truly believe we are. I think it could happen at any moment, at any day or any week, or it may not happen for 3 years or 5 years. It's not the question of if. I think it's the question of when. In fact, Senators Joe Lieberman and Susan Collins wrote an op-ed piece in New York Times about, I think, a month and a half ago, and they made exactly the same point, that enemy is going to have their own choosing. What time do they want to attack? It's not the question of if, but when. I think presidential debates, this issue was discussed. This is bubbling up more and more. So I don't think there's any doubt, and the evidence is already there. Iranians attacked the U.S. banks about a couple of months ago, and or within the last few weeks, and some of the major banks were down for hours.
Over the last several years, well, actually since 9/11, the word terrorist has become a major word in our vocabulary. So this cyber attack, would you say it would come from a terrorist?
I think there are two potential sources. One could be terrorists, enemies of the nation, who are hell-bent upon doing the damage and destroying. And the other one are criminal enterprises who are in it for money. So it could come from one of the two sources. Either one is very likely because, if we go back, if I could use an analogy, during the Soviet Union days, it required them $1 trillion or more worth of hardware, millions of boots on ground, thousands and thousands of nuclear warhead, and preparation over 50 years to be a credible threat. Today, what it takes is 10, 15, 20% team or less, brilliant people, outside-the-box thinkers with a criminal mind, and they can do more damage than what the Soviet Union did in the 50 or 60 or 70 years of their existence.
I think one of the things that some people are concerned about, John, and are actually saying it's pretty scary, is that the majority of those minds that you're talking about are young people.
Yes, that is correct.
So when you compare or you describe a cyber attack, you use the potential tsunami as what could result from a target to America. Why do you use that?
You know, the enemies are there. That could emanate from Middle East. It could emanate from potentially from China, North Korea. It could emanate from nations who have an axe to grind. In the book itself, we actually are using the Serbians who we had a bombing in 2000, and they were upset. And the book, the fiction, and covers actually that particular scenario where a few Serbians who got together and trying to attack the country. But the point I'm trying to make is that it's a band of very few people with very few tools and no military hardware who are capable of doing huge damage. For example, bringing the banking infrastructure down. Another example is actually take a pharmacy chain. If a hacker could change the names along with the medications, so just swap the names, or at the hospital, if the names are swapped, I mean, we're in real trouble. And there are a lot of these scenarios which are the outcome of the development of technology because everything is becoming connected and more connected. There's no spot left on earth where somebody's not connected with somebody electronically at this point. So what makes it so easy to use and life unimaginable without it is exactly also the curse at the same time.
So how do we stop it? What do we do to control it, prevent it? What are some of the cautions that you would urge parents, other users of computers, etc.?
So there are two different things. One is from an identity theft perspective. Just be very careful in terms of where you put out your date of birth and social. Provide only license numbers, for example, instead of social, where you can. File your tax returns early, so if somebody has stolen it, they don't have a chance to get your refund. People, for example, sometimes make a phone call to you and pretend to offer a job or I'm going to get you something, some other travel bonus. If you provide me the details, please don't. Those are more of a protection against identity theft. In terms of protection against cyber attacks, it's more of a job at institutionalized level. For example, banks have to take precautions, the pharmacy chains have to take precautions, the government has to take precautions. I'm not an expert in it. I'm a fiction writer in a lot of ways, but they have to take their precaution, and they are getting very serious about it. They keep talking about it, but simple things what folks can do, even for example, to protect against cyber attack to a degree, is like keep a list of medications, what you take in a printed form, keep it with you instead of keeping everything online. or if you are 100% online banker, just print your bank statement every month so you have a printed record which you can use, or the investments you have on Wall Street, keep a printed record of it every so often. Just by keeping something simple with you will protect you against some degree, even if there was a massive screw-up with the cyber attacks.
Now, when anyone's on a computer, sometimes you'll eventually acquire a pop-up ad, and it'll say, you've just won such and such a deal or whatever, or type in your name here and get free books, whatever. And a lot of people do that not knowing that some of those are just not really pop-up ads, but hackers.
So true. The problem is to figure out many of them are legit as giveaways for promotion. So I don't want to brand everybody with the same stroke. However, how do you make a distinction? That's the biggest problem.
How do you, John? Are there any types of I know there are a lot of filters out there. There are a lot of anti-spyware, a lot of things. But how do you know what works? And sometimes these hackers are finding their ways around these spyware tools.
I don't believe anybody has ever made a defensive wall which couldn't be penetrated. I think as long as the offenders are out there and keep testing, eventually they always get in. It's a difficult question to answer. I don't believe that there is any perfect wall out there, firewall one could create, which can defend it.
We're talking about cyberspace and identity theft, and of course, we're talking about a novel, and the name of the book is Hiding in Sunshine, and we want to remind our viewers that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the staff and management of KTEP. John, how did the name Hiding in Sunshine come about?
In the book, as we were writing and we were exchanging chapters, my daughter and I, and at one spot, I had the conversation is happening between in the family between husband and wife, and the husband basically goes, we are hiding in sunshine. If we think we are hiding, but everybody can see it, those who need to see us. And it's very similar to the question you had asked earlier. The attackers are there. They keep testing you through different pop-ups and different viruses and different things. And while we may have firewall, we think we are protected. To a degree, we are, but we are still quite visible.
Now, you mentioned your daughter, of course, is in college. The other one is not. You're working. There are people who apply for jobs on the Internet, and there are other people who are not quite ready to apply for jobs but are going to college. But as I mentioned earlier, on Facebook, they post some pretty ridiculous things. Is that something that could come back to haunt them as far as personally?
Oh, I think it's happening as we speak. The first thing people do today when a candidate comes in, they may or may not admit it, but many, many employers, regardless of the policy, it's just a human nature. First thing they will do is Google the person or Facebook, go to Facebook and check the person out or do a LinkedIn. I mean, those are the three common, most common things. Now, there's not much that's happening at LinkedIn in terms of objectionable, but Facebook certainly will show something, and that could make it or break it in terms of jobs. It's not uncommon at all. I've heard stories about it anecdotally here and there about this.
Do you recommend that people to use some of these professional networks like LinkedIn? That's the one that comes to mind.
Oh, yeah. I think it's a very useful in terms of looking for a job and so forth.
Twitter was the other one I was going to say, because a lot of people use Twitter. And in fact, in the attack on Bin Laden, when the SEALs landed there, somebody did a tweet that the Army helicopters were there.
Oh, I think Twitter, I think it's unbelievable, technology in terms of how rapidly in the last few years people have been able to connect with each other, and the dissemination of information is so rapid. I just keep getting amazed at it. Absolutely amazing. But in terms of could it come to haunt you, I mean, some of the tweets could, depending on what you do, but I'm much more concerned about Facebook as opposed to Twitter.
When you get to Facebook, you know, sometimes you'll get a request from someone and you're going, who the heck is this person? I've never heard of them or I've never seen them. And they'll say they are friends with so-and-so, which is not bad. You know, maybe you'll say, oh, yeah, I remember them. But sometimes someone wants to befriend you and you don't know who they are. And they may be 32 years old and that person on the other end is 17.
I think it's very common. And to a degree, the friendships on Facebook have become somewhat impersonal, where there are people have 500 friends, but if they saw them on the street, they probably would not recognize 450 of them.
Great point.
So if you cannot recognize them, if you don't understand them, I don't know how they are friends, but I think there must be a distinction of having friends, real friends, and virtual friends, and I think there are a lot many more virtual friends than real friends.
Well, John, are we getting, obviously you and your daughters and wife, whoever, were talking and while you were writing this book, but do you think that we're becoming more of a nation that doesn't talk to each other? Because even during the holidays, you go to people's houses, you go to restaurants, and you see a table, and everyone has an iPhone or an iPad or something in front of them, and they're either tweeting or texting, but they're not talking to each other.
That's so funny. It actually happens in my home, where my daughters are texting each other while sitting in the same room. And I always wonder about that. But at the same time, even among us, we do it between husband and wife. We email each other saying, you know, don't forget to get the milk from the grocery or something like that. So there are usage of it, but then there are practical usage of it, and then there's a continuous churning of information, which is not clear how much substance there is to it. But that's happening everywhere. I think it's the way life is, and any social I go to, it's at least quarter of the people at any point of time are doing something with their device.
When you were working in high tech, did you imagine that it was going to get to this point?
I mean, I'm still
working in it.
Working in it, and I just keep getting amazed at how quick it has been, and how easy the adoption has been, and how widespread the adoption has been. And it's fascinating to see it. There's no question about that. It's made our lives better. There's no question.
So let's talk a little bit about this book once, because we have about 4 minutes left in the program. You said that you were not marketing. You kind of wrote this for your friends and family. How do people go about getting this book?
It's available at Amazon.com. It's available at Barnes & Noble. And also, I believe iTunes carry it, but I'll have to check that. It was in the works. But Amazon and Barnes & Noble are two best sources. And book is available in hardcover, softcover, and also Kindle edition. And we have priced Kindle edition very, very low price. And it was our decision to do that because we think it's a good work of fiction, there's also a good amount of awareness as people read through it. It will raise some questions in their own mind, which was what the intent was.
You brought up a point there that just brought me to something else. You mentioned Kindle. What do you think about Kindle books? Because, you know, some people are saying Kindle books, you know, are going to take away our books. But some people say, you know, a book is always going to exist. And as President John Adams said, you'll never be alone with a poet in your pocket.
I love Kindle. I think it's when you're traveling, for example, and you wanted to carry, going from here to Japan, for example, required you to carry two books or three books or four books, just carry Kindle, and it's so easy to carry. On the other hand, when I'm at home, sometimes I actually don't read on Kindle, and I actually have a physical book to read on. So I find both of them have their own place under the sun, depending on whosoever, whatever people like. I love Kindle.
It depends on the book as well. If you're a fan of a particular author, or you're a particular fan of a particular book, you know, leather bound, you want that copy, but you also want the Kindle, maybe.
So true. And if you get a signed copy from an author, I mean, that's exciting. And you get a real book there, so you don't get that on Kindle.
Well, John, we want to thank you very much for being with us here today. And I'm sorry that Caitlin could not be with us, but the name of the book is Hiding in Sunshine, and the authors are John and Caitlin Stewart, and you can find it at Amazon.com. John, thank you very much for being with us here today.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you so much.
This is The Switch. I'm Mike Cuthbert. Music has power, especially for people who suffer the ravages of dementia. According to the Alzheimer's Foundation of America, this is because rhythmic and other well-rehearsed responses require little or no cognitive processing. Aline Ellis has this report on a music activity book that's used in caregiving facilities. It's also a lot of fun for fast-thinking seniors who like to reminisce.
Do you remember this song?
Here's a song that goes back to 1914, which was revived again in the 50s by Debbie Reynolds and Carlton Carpenter's big recording, Abba Dabba Honeymoon.
Abba Dabba 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 said the chimpy to the monk. Abba Dabba 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 said the monkey to the chimp.
I know you remember this one, written in 1910.
Sweetheart,
I'm in love with you.
I'm in love with you.
Let me hear you whisper.
Let me hear you whisper.
That you love me too.
All these old favorites are part of an activity book and CD called The Melody Lingers On. Bill Messenger is an expert in American popular music and jazz. He performs around the country and teaches at the Peabody Institute at Johns Hopkins University. He says many of his students are over 50, and he knew a lot of people love this familiar music. But he got the idea for putting this little book together when he observed a group of Alzheimer's patients being very attentive to the music.
Music connects with people when all other forms of stimulation have become totally unsuccessful.
Messenger talked with music therapists and activity directors and put together stories they could use to get conversations going. There's UB Blake's songwriting secret, for example. One time he took numbers out of the phone book and played with them and assigned each number a note and wrote the song Memories of You. The book has action songs, songs you can use for successful sing-alongs, and music for reminiscing. This is also a book for very bright, active seniors. So before each song, there are little quizzes.
They show older people who often have a kind of defeatist attitude that they do know stuff. Stuff that chances are their grandchildren and their children don't know. They know about singers and songs and about movies. And it gives them a feeling of accomplishment. Who sang You Made Me Love You to a photograph of Clark Gable in the film Broadway Melody of 1938? Judy Garland.
What singer introduced the song God Bless America in 1937? Kate Smith. Bill Messenger says there's a lot of songs he wishes he could have included, but there were copyright restrictions. His favorite song that made it in was For Me and My Gal.
The bells are ringing for me and my gal.
The birds are singing.
The birds are singing for me and my gal.
The Melody Lingers On, a complete music activities program for older adults, is published by Venture Publishing Incorporated. It gets its title from something Irving Berlin said in 1927. The song is ended, but the melody lingers on.
Sometime I'm gonna build a little home for two, or three, or four, or more.
This has been The Switch, made possible by AARP and today, Aline Ellis.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTAP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.